The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
To dwell above with saints we love, oh, that will be glory. But to dwell below with saints we know, well, that's a different story. And hence the title of our seminar today about ministering to angry sheep. You'll see in your paper that I changed the title to Angry Sheep, Angry Shepherds, because angry sheep can make angry shepherds sometimes. And this is all about how unfair criticism can drive a person almost crazy in the ministry and cause us to do things we wouldn't otherwise do. It's an examination of that. I don't know most of you. You probably don't know me. My name is Steve. I'm a minister about an hour west of here. I've been a pastor of that church not too far from Reading, PA, for 25 years. And I attended for 7 years prior to that, when it was a little house church and maybe four families in a living room, to where we met in a fire hall, to where we had a building, to where we had to expand, and now we're going to expand again. It's not a huge church. We average 450, 475, 425, depending on the week. Of course, at Easter we get more. That's the number we like to publish and so forth. But, you know, but the difference in seeing a little small church to a medium-sized church now, I've had a chance to watch what anger, both in me and in people in a congregation, can do and how devastating it can be. And that's what this is all about. Now, I realize that the idea of angry people who are ticked off at you because you are a Sunday school teacher or a youth leader or a small group leader or a pastor is all theoretical and hasn't happened yet, but you might know somebody who's actually met an angry person in his church, and this might be of some small help to you. And if you're not a pastor, but you're a youth director or a Sunday school teacher, you are going to have people really frustrated with you. It just is. It's why Martin Luther said, oh, to look into the friendly eyes of animals when talking about his congregation instead. Years ago, at this very seminar in a plenary session, James Montgomery Boyce, pastor of 10th Presbyterian, was talking, and someone raised a hand and said, sir, could I ask you, what do you consider to be the hardest thing about being in the ministry? What surprised me was not his answer, but it was the quickness with which he gave it. Without blinking an eye, without spending a nanosecond, he said, criticism. The relentless pace of criticism is the hardest thing for me to deal with in the pastorate. When you get it, it makes you have a nervous feeling, as it were. You get that feeling of political intrigues and conversations in the church parking lot, backstabbing comments, nasty grams, and my personal favorite, anonymous nasty grams, which are the best. These are the kind of things that happen to people in a ministry. The people you're ministering to are frustrated with you for reasons that you think are bad, they may be good, and they come at you. And not only when your actions are attacked, but particularly when your motives are attacked, is when you'll find it hard. That's why the first point on your paper in front of you is, did everybody get a paper? Did a few not get a paper? Can I ask who has the papers? And could you raise your hand if you don't have one, please? And we'll get them out. Okay. Anybody else? We got a couple more. The first point said that no matter what your ministry, people will become angry at you. And that will tend to make you angry at them, which is a volatile cocktail in the Christian church. They're angry with you, as we've shown up here, but your anger with them is also worth thinking about just for a second. You know how in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, it says, don't let the sun go down while you're angry. And how many times have you prayed Joshua's prayer, oh Lord, make the sun stand still? So, you just do. Because it boils and it's exquisitely difficult to put these things away just by the end of the day. Now, you know, I take it, that all anger is not sin. David Powelson, a Christian counselor who's with the Christian Counseling Educational Foundation across the street and teaches counseling courses here at the seminary, has said, the angriest person in the Bible is God. And Jesus Christ shows it. You remember at the tomb of Lazarus, when he's there in John 11, 33, it says, he sees Mary weeping, and when he saw that, he was deeply moved in spirit. And for those of you who care about such things, is that word, erema'omai. And it has connotations not only of emotional upheaval, but it has a real element of anger that is laced through it. Jesus is angry at what's going on there. Anger is something that God talks about. And we tend to think as Christians that we shouldn't get angry because the opposite of anger for us is niceness. Bad people get angry, we get nice. But Allison used this illustration instead. Thank you, babe. You're okay. Allison said this. Here, we'll call this over here sinful anger. We'll call this over here righteous anger. And we'll call this on the other end indifference. God made us as creatures who get angry when we sense injustice because that's meant to propel us to do something. And what happens is, what we often think of as mere niceness is indifference. We're not driven to make something right that ought to be made right. But indifference is as bad as sinful anger. There's a cliff to fall off of on both sides of the road. It's this middle of the road where your anger is righteous and it's channeled in a good way that God is looking for, but it's hard to do. God assumes that you'll be angry at some times. He says in Ephesians 4:26, be angry, but do not sin. It's a hard balance. So my point here is not to say don't get angry. My purpose here is to try to expose some of the dangers, the vulnerabilities that you and I have when people really tick us off in the ministry because they're ticked off at us for reasons that are just not right, and to try to help you somewhat in knowing where to go with those frustrations if possible. You ready for this? Let's just go. Point number two. People who angrily sin against you are, more importantly, sinning against God. Do you recall David, after he committed adultery with Bathsheba and had her husband knocked off? David is confessing in Psalm 51, and he says, verse 4, Lord, against you and you only have I sinned. Why would he say that? Hadn't he sinned against Bathsheba? Oh, yes. Hadn't he sinned against Uriah, her husband, whom he had killed? Oh, yes. But David is thinking, in comparison with his sin and offense against God, the offense against God was so infinitely more than even the offense against these people that by comparison, it's as if he had not even sinned against them. What he's doing is he's showing where the accent lies, where the emphasis lies, and that is the sin against God. The point is, when people are angry at you in the ministry, particularly when it's not righteous, and you're tempted to think, what are they at me for? The Bible is saying that there is a bigger player in the room other than you and the person who's ticked at you. And this is doubly true if you're a leader and they're ticked at you for that. May I illustrate with the life of Samuel? You recall that Samuel was a judge of Israel and that he had done an enormous amount of good for these people. You remember that when the Philistines were attacking, he had prayed for them. They begged him to, and God sent thunderclaps and routed the Philistines, and the people were really taken aback how good this was. And the rest of his life, God used Samuel to help against the Philistines, such that we read in 1 Samuel 7:13, throughout Samuel's lifetime, the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines. So here was a leader who had done an enormous amount of good, even to people who weren't spiritually minded, just on the secular level. And yet, at the end of his life, they said, we don't want a judge anymore, we want a king. Samuel was highly upset about that. Haven't I done what I'm supposed to do? And so he prays to God, and in 1 Samuel 8, God gives him an answer. 1 Samuel 8:7, God says, Samuel, listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected. They have rejected me as their king. You get that? This is very hard to get in your mind, that the person's relationship with God is the big picture that's going on when somebody's ticked off at you for reasons that don't make any sense to you. Paul Tripp put it this way. He said, it's not about you. What you take as so personally are really things between people and God. And you just happen to be in the neighborhood. And if you weren't in the neighborhood, many of the times someone else would be in the neighborhood and be taking the same heat that you would, maybe just for different reasons. Perhaps I could illustrate this with a youth director. A youth director is taking a lot of heat from parents. I know what that's like. I used to be a youth director. I was a youth director in Miami, Florida one time, and a dad got mad because I was talking to a boy about his salvation, and a younger kid, maybe like late elementary, early junior high, was in there just being a real pain in the neck. I opened the door, and I, you must believe me, gently eased him out with my foot and closed the door. About 5 minutes later, the screeching of tires outside, and he jacked my jaw 3 times. My head hit the blackboard where I was standing there. It happened so fast I didn't even know what was coming. So I can relate to angry parents with youth directors. What's going on when that happens? Well, you may have an unwise youth director who just shoved his kid out the door with a foot, but it may be other things like what I'm going to talk about here. Take it this way. Maybe it's that you have a parent who has a love of his reputation and his honor is so important to him. But his kid is now living in such a way that that kid is embarrassing him. And so you are not fixing my kid who is embarrassing me, and his love of honor is the real issue when you tend to think it's just his anger at you. Or maybe you have a parent who loves comfort. Here is a mother who works hard all day, and then she comes home and she would just love a few minutes to sit and kick her feet up and relax and have a cup of tea and read the newspaper. But no, the principal is always on the phone about her son. The cops are knocking at her door about her boy. And so it's just so frustrating that she can't even relax anymore, and that's what's ticking her off about you, the youth director. It's like that theologian said concerning this issue, Mr. Bill Cosby. He said, parents aren't interested in justice. They're interested in quiet. Which is exactly true. It could be that. Or it could be that a parent is a control freak. And at work, a guy is used to having everybody salute and calling the shots, and he can control his world. But he gets home, and his teenagers are not about to be controlled, and you, the youth director, are ruining his highly controlled life. You know the knock-knock joke about control freaks, don't you? Well, here. Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Control freak. Now you say, control freak who? Yeah. Well, did that up. Yeah. Well, that's the way it is with a lot of parents. It's just every little thing has to be like that, and you're not playing ball, and you're making life miserable. Or it could just be that you have a parent who just cannot come to grips with the fact that God is sovereign and that he saves people and that he matures people at his timetable. And a parent just can't deal with that. And so you are the one that happened to be walking past the target as he's shooting bullets. In summary then, when folks slander you and criticize you in the ministry, often it's because they are refusing to wrestle with their own sins, their own comforts, and their own idols, and you are not the primary issue. May I illustrate this from Scripture? Take the account of Israel and Mount Sinai and the incident of the golden calf. Moses is up on the mountain, hears all kinds of troubles down there, goes down there, what a mess,
And so God says to him in Exodus 32:7, the Lord says to Moses, "Go down, Moses, because your people, whom you brought out of Egypt, have become corrupt." Well, what's that all about? Well, of course it's all about God is distancing himself from these sinful people because he's holy. But it seems to me he's also testing Moses. After all, Moses has been leading these people by the hand for what feels like forever. Moses, do you think of them as your people? Do you think of yourself as the real big issue here? And Moses answers this marvelous little reply in Exodus 32:11. But Moses, we read, sought the favor of God and said, "O Lord, why should your anger burn against your people whom you brought out of Egypt with a great power and a mighty hand?" Which is exactly the answer God is looking for. That Moses is emotionally, even though he can't logistically, he's getting out from between the people and God. He is acknowledging their problem is a vertical problem, but to him it feels horizontal because he's the visible target. That's the idea here. And so I think what God is saying is try to get out of the middle in your mind, even though you can't get out of the middle of the situation. Remember that these people are who they're really rebelling against. May I give another biblical illustration if I could? Israel wandering through the desert and complaining. You know, most of you have read through the book of Numbers, and the complaints of Israel are perhaps the predominant theme in it. Whining all the time. Now, at first, it's only the chronic complainers who whine. We read in Numbers 11:4. Am I getting that door so just closing that if it would? Thank you. Numbers 11:4, it says that the rabble began to crave food and started wailing and said, "If only we had meat to eat." Well, you know what that's about. There are always a few people in your church. You know who they are. They're always in the corner. Nothing you do can please them. Okay, that's fine. But the poison spreads fast, doesn't it? And so you read in Numbers 11, chapter 10, "Then Moses heard the people of every family wailing." My goodness. Now the whole congregation is upset with him. Finally, it gets to the other leaders, and you read in Numbers 12, 1, his own brother and sister, leaders in Israel, are complaining. Miriam and Aaron began to talk against Moses because of his Cushite wife. Aaron is the guy who's going to be the high priest of Israel. And he's got his finger in Moses' chest, complaining about him. Later, you have the spies who go into Canaan, check it out. They come back with reports of huge grapes, but huger people. And so they say, "We can't take this place." And the folks, it says, after that, Numbers 14:2, the whole assembly says, "If only we had died in Egypt or died in this desert." Think about that. Here's what they're saying to Moses. "Moses, we would prefer to fall face down in the sand under a scorching sun, die of thirst, and have our tongues swell in our mouths than to spend one more week under your inept leadership." People who are angry, they tend to exaggerate from time to time. And it goes on everywhere. It just does. And finally, there was a move to replace Moses, as you may have had in your church. They said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." And finally, there was talk about murdering Moses in the church parking lot. Numbers 14:10, the whole assembly talked about stoning him. Now, to Moses, all this feels as if it's a horizontal issue. The people hate him. But here's how God talks about what's going on there. The unseen person in the room, so to speak. Numbers 14:26. God said to Moses and Aaron, "How long will this wicked community grumble against me?" Yeah? Or listen to Numbers 11, chapter 1. "Now the people complained about their hardship," here's a great little phrase, "in the hearing of the Lord." He's there the whole time. "And when he heard them, his anger was aroused." Or take Numbers 11, verse 10. Moses heard the people of every family wailing, and the Lord became exceedingly angry. Or God speaking to Miriam and Aaron when they rebelled against Moses. And the Lord heard this, and God said to Miriam, "Why were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" And she gets leprosy on the spot. And when God hears the people talk about stoning Moses, here's his reaction. Numbers 14:11. Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will strike them down with a plague and destroy these people." And had Moses not interceded, that's what would have happened. So, it's about God, not just you. That's the second point. Now, after all this, you might think, and I might wish, that God's major goal and his primary interest when people criticize you unfairly is to protect his servants against complaining, angry congregation. You might think that's God's primary interest, but absolutely not. Point number three is this. When others sin against you, God may deal with you if your anger goes unchecked. And the best way I can think of to illustrate this is Moses drawing water from the rock. You recall the incident. The first happened in Exodus 17. The people are absolutely dying of thirst. They're complaining and criticizing Moses. He doesn't know what to do. He can't find any water. He speaks to God, and God says to him, Exodus 17, 6, "Moses, strike the rock, and water will come out of it." And it did, and everybody was fine until they got thirsty the next time. Now, the second time that this happened, they're at another spot. They're at another rock, and the people are desperate, and they're upset, and here's what happens. It says in Numbers 20, God said to Moses, "Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water." Now, you recall what happened there. God had told him to speak. But here's how it went down in Numbers 20, verse 10. It says that Moses and Aaron, they gathered the assembly, and Moses said to them, and here in Numbers 20, 10, you can almost hear his tone of voice. I think if there were a red letter edition in the Bible, this would be in red letters, but for a different reason than usual. And Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels must rebring water out of this rock. He's just dripping with frustration." And so it says, then Moses raised his hand and he struck the rock twice with his staff, and the water gushed out. And you remember what happened as a result? The people, who were 10 times more sinful than Moses, they all got exactly what they wanted. And Moses, God said to him, Numbers 20, verse 12, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of these people, you will not bring the community into the land that I gave them." Forty years he is dragging these people around. He single-handedly, with his helper Aaron, takes them out from under the clutches of Pharaoh, being God's emissary. And now God says the whole goal of it, which is to go to that land, it's not going to happen. Moses begs God to change his mind. Deuteronomy 3, 23. Moses says, "At that time, I pleaded with the Lord." And you can hear his tone of voice, can't you? "Oh, sovereign Lord, let me go over and see that good land beyond the Jordan, that fine hill country and Lebanon." He's slobbering as he speaks. And God says, "That is enough. Do not speak to me anymore about this matter." And so came true what the psalmist wrote in Psalm 106, verse 32. "By the waters of Meribah, they angered the Lord, and trouble came to Moses because of them. For they rebelled against the Spirit of the Lord, but rash words came from Moses' lips." What an awful conundrum. Why did God do this with Moses? Discipline him so severely? And why will God sometimes discipline you for your anger at people whose sins vastly outstrip your sins? Well, that's reason number four. We turn the page. Why would God do this? Because by making yourself the focus, you unknowingly distract from what God is doing. Well, what was God doing? Well, in short, God is always interested in showing his glory, and what Moses did hid the glory of God. You can probably think of multiple ways that happened, but I can think of two major ones. First, it hid the glory of God in that it gave the people an excuse to sin. The implication in the text, to me at least, is that the people knew that God had said he must speak to the rock. Because in Numbers 20:12 it says, "You didn't trust me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of these Israelites." In other words, these people had 99% of the problem. Moses had 1% of the problem. But God saw that by Moses, the leader, sinning, he gives an excuse to the others. The others say, "Hey, look, Moses, he didn't exactly obey every jot and tittle of the law, did he? And so why do I have to?" That's the idea behind it. And you will find, and I'm sorry to say this is hard, but I have certainly found, when I've been in relationships with people, and doubtless you've had that, where there's a tension, and you truly do believe that 95% of the fault is theirs. But there's some small part that is yours, if you think about it, you must grant. Many people will not do business with the Lord until you get right your 5%, even if their sins are coming out of every pore. And it's doubly true if you are a leader. Is it fair? No. Is it true? Oh, yes. It is. But the second reason, then, is not just giving people an excuse to sin, but the second way in which Moses hid God's glory is even far more serious, and that is Moses, by his anger, marred the main thing God was doing at the moment. What was God doing? What was he about? What was he trying to teach? I don't like to use the word try with respect to God, but you know what I mean. What was he teaching at the incidents of the rock? Well, you know, as you read through the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 10, Paul looks back on the wilderness wanderings, and he says that the people ate spiritual food, although it was earthly manna, and they drank from that spiritual rock, which was Christ. He says that the rock is emblematic, it's pictorial, of Jesus Christ, because from it flows life-giving water that tastes wonderful in a place where nobody has any idea where it's going to come from, and they're going to die if they don't get it. It's like at the Feast of Tabernacles, where Jesus sees the people pour out water, because they do that at that feast, because it is to recognize and remember when God gave water from the rock in the wilderness wanderings. With that as a backdrop, Jesus stood up and he said, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me." That's the whole idea. God is teaching about Jesus Christ all the time. Now, think of God's pictures with the two rocks and the difference between them. With the first rock, God told Moses to strike it. What was he supposed to strike it with? With his rod. Exodus 15:5, the Lord said to Moses, "Take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and strike the rock." This staff was not emblematic of a kindly shepherd's crook. This staff was the rod of God's judgment. That's the way it's always used in the Old Testament, in the Pentateuch. Exodus 7:19, the plagues of Egypt. God says to Moses, "Tell Aaron, take your staff, stretch it over the waters of Egypt," and they were all turned to blood. Exodus 8:5, "Tell Aaron, take the staff in your hand, stretch it out over the streams and canals, and frogs will come up from everywhere." Exodus 8:16, "Tell Aaron, stretch out your staff and strike the dust of the ground, and throughout Egypt the dust will become gnats." Now, by the time of the book of Revelation, the rod of God's judgment has become the scepter of iron with which the Messiah rules as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords and crushes the nations. It says in Revelation 2:27, he will rule them with an iron scepter and he will dash them to pieces like pottery. So what is the picture when Moses is asked to strike the rock? It is the picture of Christ being smitten with the rod of God's judgment. It's a picture of the cross. And from that smiting in judgment comes living water for the most inconceivably undeserving people. And it's glorious. Now take the second rod. How often must Christ be struck with the rod of God's judgments to pay for the sins of his people? Oh, yes. Everybody's here been reading Hebrews, haven't you? Sure. Hebrews 7:27. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. Hebrews 9:12. He entered the holy place once for all by his blood and obtained eternal redemption. Hebrews 10:10. We've been made holy through the sacrifice of Christ's body once for all. And thus, Moses was told, having already struck the rock once, now to speak to the rock. Why? Because once Jesus has died, the way that we access God's salvation is to confess with our mouths that Jesus is Lord and pour out words of repentance and belief to him. It's to pray with our mouths to God to have mercy on our souls. By striking the rock once, Moses preached the gospel. By striking the rock twice, Moses shamed the gospel. And Moses cast a shadow of what would be one of the most important pictures in the entire Old Testament of the saving work of Jesus Christ. And thus he hid the glory of God, and he did so by his anger at the people who were angry at him. Think of that. I had to mention in the first hour that part of the training that we're trying to give here at the seminary today is to illustrate things that you shouldn't do when you speak in order that you won't lean too far over the pulpit and knock it over from the hymn book to hold it up. And this is just extra. We want you to learn all you can. There we go. Now, what's interesting is this. Moses, of course, did not realize what the picture was that he was marring. He didn't know all that God was doing when he got angry. You don't know all that God is doing when you get angry. God just tells you to conduct yourself in a godly way. What is it that God is doing that our anger is liable to hide? Well, that's number five. What is God doing? He's maturing you, and he's healing the sins of other people who make your life difficult. I'm not going to make a comment about maturing you other than to say this chafing that takes place in your life is given directly by God to make you more Christ-like, and you will be a far better minister or small group leader from having brushed up against people who are difficult than you would if you were with the most placid congregation on the planet, giving brilliant lectures based upon Boss, Ritter Boss, and everyone else that you've read, and have no experience of feeling your own anger rise up and your own sins flowed out and the need you have of the cross of Christ. But beyond that, he's not just maturing you, he's healing those who sin against you. I have the last remaining piece of chalk on Westminster Seminary's campus, and I'm going to try to use it for this. Years ago, a man named Bill Gothard drew this little diagram, which I found extremely helpful about this. He said, let's make this cross stand for Jesus Christ. And here is a soldier. And that soldier is holding a whip with which he beats Jesus Christ bloody and puts him on the cross. Now, Peter wrote about that whipping when he said this. 1 Peter 2:23. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, Christ made no threats, but he committed his cause to God, who judges justly. He bore our sins in his own body on the tree. By his wounds, you have been healed. How does that relate to anger in the ministry?
It relates this way. It says, by his wounds, you have been healed. Who is it that gave the wounds to Jesus Christ? Well, it's a soldier holding this whip. And this soldier, if he believes, his wounds are going to be healed. But whose sins were they that made it necessary for that soldier to whip Jesus Christ back? It's the guy who's talking to you. It's the people you're sitting with. It's us. And so I put my name right here because for all intents and purposes, I was the one who whipped Jesus Christ back. Does that make sense? By his wounds, you are healed. Jesus, by not retaliating and by committing his cause to God, brought the spiritual healing of my soul by his response. And that's what Christ, the verse following says, he did this to give you as an example. I'm sorry, it's before the paragraph. The idea then is that he wants you to respond to the very people who make your life hell on earth in such a way that they have never seen the Lord. Because they finally see someone treat their obnoxious selves the way that Jesus treated the people who put him on the cross. And that is often what it takes to bring those people to Christian maturity, or in some cases, to faith in the first place. That's what God is doing. It's one of the things that he's doing.
Well, how this ended with the man who left a message on my phone, I want to play for you now, just before I leave you with just a couple practical suggestions of dealing with angry situations in your church. We went on to a service of excommunication, and my respect was so high because all of them knew the threat of lawsuits that hung over them, and they knew how serious Jeff was. And he was excommunicated publicly at a service, and then it took several years. But eventually, that isolation and loneliness and God making his life miserable, as Paul talks about in Corinthians, did its work. And at his service of reception back into the membership of the church, here is what we heard. The tape will run out before the transcription runs out, but between the two of it, you'll be able to get it. Let's turn it off. I'm sorry. It worked earlier. We're having a little trouble with it. Thank you. I'll just use the restoration. I wish you could hear his voice. You would not recognize him. You would not know the man. The humility with which he spoke. The first word that comes to my mind was arrogance. I was extremely disrespectful. I said, talking with Steve's wife, Verna, on the telephone, I believe it was last night. Trust me, she didn't pay to say this. But I said that with the elders that are at this church, I have a hard time now understanding why anyone would have difficulty following their leadership. But I was defiant and angry and arrogant. I do know the pain, not the depth of it, but the pain and hardship I brought to the lives of my kids and my wife. And I certainly ask the forgiveness from all of you, and especially the elders, for my arrogance and for my contempt and for my disrespect. This is the healing of Jesus Christ working into a person. It did not come just from people being nice to Jeff. It came from people being nice, patient. I would say that our church spent not hundreds, but thousands of man hours with this man and his wife and his children. But that, combined with the godly firmness from leaders who loved him and who took heat from him and initially from his wife, this is what happened. This is the way God works. And it was glorious. Wish you could have been there. May I just give a few practical ideas? I think we just shut it down now, Matt. Thank you so much. A few practical ideas that I found helpful when people are highly angry with me, and maybe one of these might be somewhat helpful to you. The first is this.
When people criticize you, even if a large percent of what they said is dead wrong, there is almost always a kernel of truth in what they're saying. And the best thing you can do is to have the humility to find what that kernel is and acknowledge it and repent of it. Years ago, I was in a situation with our elders that I don't have time to go into here. I'd like to. But it was extremely painful for me. It was one of the most painful things in my life. I came a millimeter from walking away from the Christian ministry. I just couldn't believe some of the interactions we had, and I was hurt beyond words, and it was the first time I really knew what depression was. I'd never known what depression was before. I had a few days there. I could not get out of bed. I lost 17 pounds, and I simply didn't know what to do. One of the very few people I talked to was John Bettler. John Bettler was the former CEO, president of the Christian Counseling Educational Foundation before Tim Lane ran it, and I met for lunch with him. I love lunch, but I didn't need a bite. And he saw that, and he heard what I had to say, and he heard the, oh my goodness, the bizarre situation we had with a staff member who had threatened to kill his wife and so forth. I mean, it was about as weird as you could get. But the way it twisted and complicated, I thought my ministry life was over. And he listened for a long time, and he said two things. He said, "Steve, this particular staff person you're talking about, I think he's a psychopath," which was wonderful to hear. And he said, "Secondly, what those elders talked to you about when they turned their guns on you and said ways they thought you were at fault, I would do everything I could to try to think through and listen to what they say to you. And as best you can, find what they're saying to you that's true and embrace it." So at a time when I could barely button up my shirt in the mornings, I spoke to every person who was on our church staff at the time, and I called every person who had ever been on our church staff. The elders had spoken to me and had said that their observation about me was that I was too detailed in how I would approach projects and events and frustrate people. And I would like to know if while you were here, or if you're here right now, if I frustrate you or frustrated you, I'd like to hear it. Of all those people, only one person was venomous, and she was very venomous. And thank you very much. all the others, here's how the reaction generally went. "Oh, Steve, we really like you. You're a great guy. We like you. Thank you very much. Do I frustrate you?" And then I would hear some stories that I had never heard and never knew. It was one of the more humbling experiences of my life, as you can imagine. But I tell you this, is one of the most helpful experiences in my entire ministry life I ever went through. And I suspect that every one of you, sooner or later, probably sometime in your ministry, ought to have that kind of conversation with your family, your spouse, your children, your staff people, your Sunday school class, your small group, and just invite, "What do I need to change?" And then really listen. Throw away is not true, because it will not all be true. I would say that 90% of what those elders said to me when they read me a letter of where they thought I really needed to change, by the time I had spoken to all the staff members and gone back to them and discussed it, I would say that they backed up on 90% of it and said, "No, I understand your explanations here. No, you're right. No, I see we misread that. We really did misread that. But the 10% was so valuable, I can't tell you how valuable it was. Your human pride will scream to you not to do this. That is an enormous mistake, because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble." Second suggestion. When there have been people, and there have not been many, I am not by nature I don't hold grudges easily, just by personality. It's not a virtuous thing. I just don't. And So these people have been few, but the few people in my life that I've had who have made my life so exquisitely difficult, I just could hardly stand the thought of them. Bible study would not help me. Just general prayer would not help me. Lord, change me would not help me. The only thing at times that I found would help me, and this would, is to pray down blessings on those people's heads. And not to do it, not just, Lord, bless Mr. Smith today, amen, but Lord, bless Mr. Smith today. Let's take his business. Lord, would you make his business thrive? Would you bring a lot of customers to his store? Would you send him into chapter 11 tomorrow? Would you? You got to say it. And then, Lord, bless his kids. May he have a great relationship with his kids. May his kids just love him, Lord. May they give him hugs when he comes home at night, Lord. Especially that fat, ugly kid. He's Lord, especially, you got to say it. There is nothing that I found that would help you, if it's highly angry to you unrighteously, than to strongly pray repeatedly for their good. Their spiritual life, their economic life, their sex life, their educational life. Pray for it all. Next. When you're doing this, I would urge you to praise your opponents behind their back whenever you can. If you do it from phony, manipulative motives, this doesn't work. But for you to say when you're in a conversation, oh yeah, and you have to think. You have to be creative, because a lot of times you can hardly think about anything about Mr. Smith that even makes him worthy of slurping his planet. And so you think, is there anything in him? Yes, in his entire being there is one cell that I can think of that is good. You know that Mr. Smith, he has got the greatest cell walls and the most attractive nucleus in that cell I've ever seen. He really is good at that. But truly, to learn to praise something about him to other people when he's not there is something, and you will find that eventually your heart will follow your words. I don't know why that is true. It just is true. Another thing, I would recommend that in trying to love a person or pray for a person, you don't shoot for the home run when you can only hit a single. Here's what I mean. Years ago, probably in this very room, when I was in a practical theology course, the professor said the following. At the time, it was all guys, and it was all guys going in the ministry. So he said, now, you ministerial students, he said, if you are ever at the point in a meeting where you want to cuss out an elder, he says, I strongly suggest that just wait till you're alone in the parking lot and say it to the air. I'm thinking, I'm paying tuition for this. But I thought about it over the years. Here's what he's saying. Is he saying you ought to be cussing out in the parking lot by yourself? No, he's not saying that. He's saying there are times when spiritually you are so low and you are so vulnerable and you are so oppressed, and you know you ought to be rising to this level, and you just can't rise to that level. Rise to some level. Do some small thing that you can. And if the only thing you can do is wait another 15 seconds till you pass Mr. Smith, till you get out in the parking lot, and in the darkness shake your fist at the moon and cuss him out there, at least do that. I hope the tape recorder is not going. I hope you know what I mean. Find what you can do and do, and then pray to Christ to forgive you for all that you didn't do and should have done. Because God sees your heart. He will forgive you when you repent. And he will appreciate the tiny effort you're making at a time when the smallest effort feels like a Herculean effort to you. And lastly, two things. One, there is a place for being a tough guy. There is a place for sitting someone down and really telling them what's wrong. The temptation will be to do it wrongly. And so you've got to do it rightly. It's right to excommunicate somebody if he doesn't listen. It's right to have a conversation, you really hurt my feelings, or you really drive me crazy sometimes. May I urge you strongly, positive things should be written in notes. negative things should be said face to face. May I say this again? I cannot emphasize this strongly enough. Positive things, say them in notes. Negative things, always say them face to face. Why? Because that note that you crafted that you think ought to be Nobel Prize winning material because of its subtlety and its cleverness and the vocabulary and its penetrating message and nuance and so forth, he reads it or she reads it, it's all in black and white. It's stark. And what you meant as sometimes you drive me crazy, they read as sometimes you drive me crazy, because that's all they see. They can't see or hear your tone of voice. And many times, well, have you not experienced this? You've gotten a note. I've gotten notes from people where they seem so angry, and I talk to them and I say, boy, I saw you're pretty angry at me. Hey, I wasn't there. It's always men who say that. It just is. Lastly, if you're finding that people are making your life absolutely hellish, could I urge you to do the following? Pick a very small group of people, the number you're about to determine. 2, 3, 4, does it have to be 5? Maybe, I don't know. Pick a few people to whom you can share how Mr. Smith drives you nuts. And if you need to, say it in the detail you need to get their advice and their help. And that will do two things. One, you need a few people that you can truly unburden your heart to. Proverbs says that the value of friend comes in the frankness of the counsel that you know you give each other. But then don't talk about them to people outside that small group. That way you can have a group that you can express your frustrations to and get advice from, but you're not gossiping about a person to everybody and his brother. And your friends will do. If they see that you are wrong in certain places, they'll be frank with you, and then you can learn from that, but you won't be ruining a person's reputation all over the church. There's so many things we could say more. I feel for you. I see how young many of you are. And I know how many years you have of many times very difficult relationships. But I would tell you this. If you will honor Christ in this arena we're talking about today, which in my opinion is one of the hardest arenas on the planet to honor Christ in, if you would learn to forgive people who hate you, pray for those who despitefully use you, keep your comments to a minimum of people. If you will learn to get the stripes and heal them spiritually through it and so forth, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is what Christianity looks like. This is what deeply pleases God. And God, who sees you in secret, will reward you openly on that great day.